South African strangleist apartheid. And today we're going to look at the topic of the involvement of white South Africans in the struggle against apartheid, with special focus on one particular South African leader. His name is Christian Frederick Beyers Nodi. You can just pass this and have a look at him. And my name is Molefe Tsile, and the tape might start rolling. I am with Mudiehi, who's going to help me in having this discussion and throwing some light into a number of important phases in the life of Beyers Nodi. And in general, we would be asking, how did white Christians get along with that society? And out of the development of Beyers Nodi's life, you will get an idea about that. And so the discussion is going to be focused on mainly four phases of his life. The early phase, when he was still a growing up in Afrikaner national family. And then the second phase is when he started to have a crisis and what you call the awakening phase, when you can say that is Damascus experience phase. And then the third phase is after that, the pressures which were put upon him, the conflict he has had now, the confrontation he has with the government. And then we'll conclude that with his later years, which means the present, what role is he playing in South African life now? And then Mudiehi can then lead. It's going to be a conversation. You can interrupt anytime, ask questions, and then Mudiehi can clarify, or I can help clarify. And the purpose is just to gain a more understanding as to what are the forces that shape the lives of Christians in that country?
Yeah, the first thing is to understand especially how whites in particular, especially Beyers in this instance, became to be involved in the issues that faced a lot of blacks in the apartheid situation. And that helps us to also, that can also help us to understand a lot of people who are working towards the racism in America, and how the people can be transformed, even if they had a very high support and influence in their own situation, their own white sectors and what they believe in. Okay. Beyers was born in a Christian family, and his parents were, his father was a minister, and his uncles and all that. And he had four brothers and a sister. And when he grew up, his parents were always emphasizing the importance of respect, obedience to the family or to the elders. And then his mother aspired that day he become a minister, because of that she was also thinking that if you are in high position, he was more concerned with status for his children. And he saw ministry and his children being pastors as a part of that. But his early involvement as a minister, he took that upon himself. Although he had the influence of the mother, but it was more on his part. Okay. His father was an Afrikaner, and he believed in the African nation. And at the time, there was a lot of conflict between the English and the Afrikaner. And so they were advocating for African nationalism, and the the opening up of schools for Afrikaner and the use of Afrikaans as a medium of instruction.
Afrikaner is Dutch primarily?
Primarily Dutch, but then it evolved to become what you call Afrikaans now, which is a little bit different to Dutch much later in the years. They were somehow would consider Dutch as a little bit part of it, but then there were some associations formed to establish Afrikaans as a language, and all the people who were, especially immigrants to South Africa, they saw Afrikaans as their language. Okay. And so his father had commanded a very high respect in the community as an advocate of Afrikaans as a language and Afrikaner nationalism. And then when there was the Anglo-Boer War, he was very disturbed, because then they had to relinquish them, because then a lot of Boers were put into concentration camps, the children and the families, the mothers and the children. And so there was a lot of hatred between the English and the Afrikaner. But when the treaty was signed between them, they had no option, because they felt at that time that there's nothing that they can do. But they had to sign a treaty between themselves and the English. But later they would also push forward to establish themselves fully and separately from the English. And then his father was spearheaded also the establishment of Afrikaans in schools. And the first school was established in Roodepoort. In Roodepoort. It's a little town west of Johannesburg.
And the father was a minister in that town.
In the town.
That was the first African school in the Transvaal province.
Actually, at that time in the whole of South Africa.
Yeah.
And Beyers didn't see education as such, or even his lecturers as being part of the people who formed him, who were part of his development in what he was to become later. One of his lecturers was a prominent Afrikaner who was Hendrik Verwoerd. He was he later became the Prime Minister of South Africa, and he was the one who wrote all the laws of Bantu education, separation of education for different races.
And I think that the other thing is that Beyers' father was not only a national Afrikaner nationalist, but he was also a patriot in that sense. He for example, fought in the army against the British. And when the First World War started, he was one of those people who sided with were sympathetic to the Germans against the British in the war. And one of the generals who fought who was very prominent in against the British, his name was Christian Frederick Beyers. Now, in honor of that general, a very well-known general, when he had his son in 1915, just at the outbreak of the First World War, he named his son, the whole three names of that general became the names of Beyers Nodi. Mm-hmm. So he's a Christian Frederick Beyers, and then they added that. So you can see that the name itself links him up with a nationalist hero of the Boer commandos. It's like something like Norman Schwarzkopf, somebody.
Yeah. Also, the economic plight of the Afrikaner shortly after the war led to what was formed in 1980, the Afrikaner Bruder Bond. This is like a white bond, an association that had strong feelings about the nationalist government, which was a pro-African and everything. They had one of their influence or the things they worked for was that the people, those who belong to the African, should promote Afrikaners into all sectors of society. If there was a situation where there was a post in school, they would advocate that the Afrikaner should occupy that post, whatever qualifications or whatever intelligence or anything that has to do with that, but the Afrikaner should occupy that space. And the establishment of businesses, they would push with them so that any land, they should take it over, any businesses, they wanted to have prominence in society. And then, but given that the father he encouraged his children to learn both the languages, Afrikaans and English, so that to heal, he thought that it's advisable that the children have the knowledge of both languages to be in contact with their own people, as well as being able to communicate with the enemy if need come. Beas was very involved as a student at university level. He was involved with the editing of he was the editor of a student newspaper. He belonged to the Afrikaner, it was what you call African Association of Culture for Afrikaners, which means they would come together and celebrate whatever they felt was necessary for a culture. One of the things was what we call the Great Trek, which means at the time, when there was a time when it was left the Cape, in protest against the laws that the English had established in the Cape, because there were a lot of fights between the Xhosa and the Afrikaners over land, and the English being the ruling power then had to negotiate and put some laws that Afrikaners can't go beyond certain rivers, they have to stay within certain limits, and that caused a lot of friction, and they felt that they should go into the land and establish themselves inside. So the whole African culture was celebrating the Great Trek, one of the commemorations, and then the what you call now the covenant, the December 16th covenant, whereby they felt that the God has they have made a covenant with God. When they defeated the Zulus during the Dingane, when they defeated Dingane during the Zulu War, and some of that was one of the celebrations as a culture, and then he was also, and then in 1933 there was a rift between the students, because as this movement of Bruderbund and African culture was gaining prominence, there was a rift between student bodies. Actually, there was one student body which you call the National Union of Students, South African Students, and they felt that the Afrikaners felt that it was a pro-English movement or student body, but then they felt that they should have a separate student body from the English, there was an establishment of the Afrikaans and National Student, ANS, which was regarded as an opposition to NUSAS.
Excuse me, was this at one university in South Africa, or a university with Watersang, or which?
At this time, it was only in Stellenbosch, because Stellenbosch, that's where he went to school. Stellenbosch was predominantly Afrikaner, and then if most of the leaders in South Africa went to Stellenbosch University.
Mm-hmm. And where's that located?
Stellenbosch in the Cape. It's right at the southern tip there. Mm-hmm. And so they felt that they should have, let's say, a student body of their own. And in 1933, there was the first, in 1936, there was the first establishment of ANS in Africa. But then this spread to other universities as well.
And I think the other thing is that just about the Bruder Bond. Had Beyers joined the Bruder Bond by that time?
No, he joined it when
he joined 2016. It, okay.
Yeah. So, but also, he was in 1937, he was elected the president of ANS. Wow. And he felt he was an independent person, he was also involved in the Libertate. That was another journal in the university, which was formed by some English anonymous people. But it was a newspaper journal which was looking at situations of students and the church and the Afrikaner culture itself and the politics of the day, questioning certain things. And his father was very curious. Well, how can he be? Because they were both involved, his brother and himself, they were both involved in the Liberty. And his father was very curious, how can he involve himself in this kind of journal when he knows where he stands as Afrikaner? But to him, he felt that it was a way of looking critically at situations when they unfold, whether it be politics or even the culture of Afrikaners themselves, because he felt at that time that he as a student, he has to have an open mind and not just take whatever is given. And that was one of the fundamentals in what was to become of him later in life. Because he was born in a very strong Afrikaner hold, and it wasn't easy for anybody to shake that.
And the other thing is that because his father was a minister, he was able to, they were able to move to many parts of South Africa which are Afrikaner stronghold. He was born in Roodepoort, but then from there they moved to the Cape, half Rainet, and then they moved to another area. So they went to Potchefstroom, and Potchefstroom is one of the stronghold of Afrikanerdom. If you remember the referendum which was held last few months ago, that referendum was proposed after the present government lost a by-election on the Potchefstroom seat, which was made vacant by the death of one in the city, and they panicked when they lost that seat, because since that time already it has always been a stronghold of Afrikaner national. So Beyers, therefore, from his early youth, was able to get the feel and be introduced to important Afrikaner people in every one of those who his father was as a minister.
When the Great Depression came, there were two rival Afrikaners, one was Smuts and the other Herzog. And Smuts was the one who was on the side of the British when they fought against the Germans. And Herzog has always maintained that they shouldn't go into the war. So when there was a Great Depression, there was a strong, because a lot of whites, what do you call it, poor whites were emerging. And there was a strong feeling that they should establish themselves in all the sectors so that they improve the lives of people. And so, but because of the depression, there was a joint, they joined hands together to fight the depression and all that. Both Herzog and Smuts. that angered also his father's feeling. How can they do that when these people are not reconcilable? But the real crux of the matter came about during his early ministry. Not only was he a natural leader, but he was a very confident person, who was a very strong personality. And so when he first went into ministry as now qualified minister, one of the senior ministers in his church came up to him and asked him to join the Buddha Bond, which is this community. At that time, you couldn't just go up and join the offices. You had to be pinpointed by somebody who felt that you are a strong leader, you advocate for African nationalism, and well, in some other instances, you had some sort of money, you're an established person. And so they asked Bayers to join the group. And because he was, for all that, he accepted the offer and joined. And they had an initiation whereby the other members would come to their house and they would read all these oaths and what they would take an oath and whatever. But it was a very secretive organization. And he was not supposed to divulge any information, what the bond stands for, what it's all about. So it was a very secretive organization.
It's mainly something similar to some orders of the KKK in the US.
Mm-hmm.
You only divulge who are the members at the pain of death, and even if you can fall between you and some others and you resign, at least one thing you respect is never say what happens within the Bruder Bond.
Mm-hmm.
Once you can say that, it doesn't matter what you will do or who you will be, you'll never be forgiven for the rest of your life. It's not just also innocent, because it is the power making, the kingpin. That's where presidents are appointed. There is no single prime minister of South Africa who has never been a Bruder Bond. That's where ministers of police are appointed. Every, whether it's a head of a university, head of a broadcasting corporation, head of sometimes even heads of foreign missions, you have to have a connection within the Bruder Bond. But nobody would know. And you, even if you may have money, intelligence, education, and you can't join unless they ask you to join. You are invited. You may be an active voter of the Nationalist Party for the rest of your life. They will be studying you, whether are you reliable. And so you must begin to see that the fact that he was invited to join was in itself, it meant a lot. That this is, they already began to see that this person is likely to become a future prime minister of this country. And the fact that he accepted also meant that he really believed and was committed. The basic rule is that, are you prepared to serve the interest of the folk above any other interest, and sometimes actually even above the interest of God? And you must be willing to say yes. Then you make that oath, you sign, and Bears then pass through that initiation.
At that time, also, a lot of things were unfolding. They were separate, because all the towns were separate, blacks and white, the neighborhoods were separated. So there were missionaries who served on other in other groups, like you have like Bayers would serve in the colored congregation. So when he went there, he found some injustices and some unsettling things, like the poverty, the illiteracy, a lot of the colored people were not educated beyond a certain measure, and there was no guarantee that their children would be educated, because most of them were working in the vineyards, in the cane vines, as a helping farmers, and their only privilege was to on Sundays to be able to go to church and meet each other, and to them it was joy. But then when he saw that, he began to question the involvement of the church, and how does this church manifest itself, how does it see itself in that kind of situation. And at least he thought that the church should try and improve the lives of these people. But that didn't end there. And when in the 1940s, the National Party won, after the war, the Second World War, they won the national votes.
They just won the elections.
They won the elections.
They defeated the Smart Party.
Yeah.
Also.
Yeah. And that meant a real change in government and in the church as well. And then the government started advocating for separate laws for different races. And that meant between 1945 and 1950, there were a lot of laws that were implemented, racial laws, just when apartheid was starting. A lot of apartheid laws which were established, among the separation of the neighborhoods there, and that meant that certain areas were declared white areas, like especially in urban areas. If you go to Johannesburg, there was a lot of mixing, even within Johannesburg, you wouldn't even know whether this is a white section or what. But at that time, all the people who were living within the Johannesburg area were moved out to other settlements, and that meant a lot of upheaval, uprooting of families. Even as that, businesses, a lot of Indian businesses they had to evacuate them. And when a lot of Indians and Indian ministers and ministers, Indians confronted their ministers, their church ministers, and asked them to intervene on their behalf because they had established businesses and all that. And some of them, because Bayas was in the synod as a moderator, then the church asked him to monitor the situation, because then the church felt, well, it can be done, but in a moderate way. If you move people to certain areas, you have to try and see the situation if it's feasible, and if it's not feasible, try to do that in a just way. But at that time, Bayas, he didn't do anything. He just looked at the situation and he didn't recommend anything. And a lot of people were becoming bitter and towards the government and the church for not doing anything. And then, and that is also because at that time he was a very strong supporter of what the Buddha Bond was. Because it was advocating for separation and for African nationalism. So they didn't find, at that time, they didn't find it necessary or appropriate to even look at other people, what other people are going through. It was just for himself and his own people. So, and a lot of people then, even the church at that time, started to look at the situation, and he said, well, it is completely behind the government policy. And also they had a synod, and where they decided to adopt themselves the separation of races. And a lot of English speaking people were very curious about that. How can a church, you know, the government and on its own also advocate for separation of races? And one of them, because the most of the churches in South Africa belong to the World Council of Churches, where the what do you call it, Pentecostal, the CPSC.
The Church of the Province of
Church
South
of
Africa.
Province.
The Anglican Church.
The Anglican Church. Most of the English people were in the ministers also in the Anglican Church. They wrote drafts or letters to the World Council of Churches to have them minister the Enkhier Kerk, which is the Dutch church, to be kicked out of the World Council of Churches because of their support for the government of South Africa and all that. And that opened up a lot of dialogue between the church, the churches of churches, and the World Council of Churches. And because World Council of Churches wanted to, and because there was now a rift between churches, World Council of Churches wanted all their member churches in South Africa to have some understanding and cooperation. So they sent a delegate to South Africa to try and get people understand the crisis of races and church and society, how all that is related, and also to help them get another view which they might not be aware of, how you know what conflicts can cause the races and the church and in society. So there was a big consultation in what you call it, Kotelsloe. And that was in around 1960s or so. And then the whole consultation, they had a draft letter, there were recommendations talking between, and they had everything was rounded up at the end. They had a resolution to make that they reject the government implementation of the racial laws, and that if anything should happen, the churches also should try by all means to work with the government in showing the government how crucial these issues are, and it might lead to a real breakdown between people and even lead to wars or whatever. But at the end, the MTL camp, they were also part of that. But at the end, the Prime Minister then issued a letter in the newspaper that they condemned the resolutions taken by the consultation, and they had got nothing to do with it. And then this issue of the letter, the newspaper report, made a turning point on the life of the players, because he felt that they were going forward, you know, with the trying to understand people's feelings as a church, and because he was also a Buddha bond, he couldn't outwardly say what his point was as far as the draft resolution and what the Buddha was saying. So he was in a conflict with himself. But then, he started on his own, because the seminar that he went to didn't prepare him for church and state relationship or politics as such. He felt that on his own he needed to go out and read as much books as he can on these issues. And then he started reading on himself a lot of books on church and state. And then he thought that he also took a 6-week tour of Germany, overseas tour, just to see how different countries were working on this issue. And then he was with another colleague, and he got a shock of his life when he got out that day. Because now people were asking how do blacks live, how do colors live, what is the situation in South Africa. And because he was in his own camp, otherwise he didn't know how blacks lived, how colors lived, except for the only situation where he had to go into a colored area and serve as a minister. And he had no questions, no answers to most of the questions. And when he came back, he didn't even write a report on what he confronted outside, but just to say, well, I had a lot of experience and a lot of safety. But then later on, when he came back around 1960, there was a Sharpeville massacre of people, because now on the ground, a lot of blacks were now confronting the government laws, and especially the past laws, which were the government used to separate people and to keep people in certain areas. Only people born within the rural areas, the urban areas, were allowed to work in the areas, in urban areas. But most of the people were put out in what we call reservations, for different ethnic groups, and you couldn't come and work in rural areas. They had a lot of laws and pass and whatever. So black people started rejecting the pass laws. And by, starting from 1950s, 55 or so, where people had been arrested for pass laws and people demonstrated. And but then in 1955, the people started to adopt what we call the Freedom Charter.
Oh.
The Freedom Charter, which advocated a lot of law and statements about what people felt about themselves, that they are people and they have the right to homes, right to education, right to housing, right to whatever is available, not only for whites, for blacks as well, and they have the right to live wherever they feel like they want, and they shouldn't be restricted because of their race. But then in 1960, there was a defiance campaign by the ANC and PAC, and whereby the police, when people were starting to throw their passes away, put some match on them, throw them, make bonfires of pass of the reference books. And the government reacted by sending police who shot 69 people who died on that day. And then a lot of churches came out to see how the situation was, and it was a really pathetic situation. And a lot of churches started to speak out against the government and their reaction to the situation. And Bayers also, he at that time was still not certain of what was right as a minister, or as a white person, or as a being of God.
I think at that time the government explanation was that this should be blamed on communist agitators.
Mm-hmm.
And Bayers also told that line, that the government is, it had no choice, they are communist agitators who are doing this, and so he followed that interpretation. And the Anglican bishops were very active in rallying the world against what happened at Sharpeville. And that is when they sent the World Council of Churches to go and investigate what happened. What are the facts? Because the Anglican Church blames the government blames the ANC as communists, and Bayers, his position was that the ANC has just a little support. Black people are happy to carry these passes. That was his understanding. And when the WCC sent a delegation from a person from America, Bill Meyer was his name, he was a Presbyterian, and he met with the Anglican delegation and said, what is happening? And they gave him an explanation. No, surely we're not perfect, but there is room for improvement under these circumstances. we are trying to do our best. If only we can get support from the English. And that's when they formed, they said, let's have this conference at Cottesloe to say what do the scriptures say about what's happening, and what are the facts. And there were problems, where will the conference be held, because it has to be include blacks, and then there was no venue for mixed delegation. In the end, it was held at Cottesloe, which was a boarding house of a university. But still, even the Cottesloe, this boarding house had wings, and one wing had to, blacks were to stay there, the other wing, whites. But there was some space left in the wing where blacks were staying, because only about a third of the delegates were blacks. So they had to put some whites, but then they had to ask only those whites who don't mind to stay in the room where there are blacks. And Bayers himself wrote a letter to some of the delegates who were coming to say, you know, we've got a problem. We need those people who don't mind staying. Will you be willing to stay with in a room where there are blacks? And in the end, the story is such that when the resolution of Cottesloe was agreed upon, the Dutch Reformed delegation were the people who wrote that resolution, which was a compromise statement, very liberal, very watered down. And basically it said that in principle, as Christians, we cannot support a differentiation of races. But at the same time, we recognize that there are problems in this country, and so we must try to find the best fare and so on. And therefore, that we then think that it's wrong for churches to be racially divided, it's wrong for black people not to have the same rights as white have, and so on. And it was those clauses that the Prime Minister, when they read those clauses, they said, no ways. And so then the Dutch Reformed Church, which had sent a delegation of people to attend that conference, immediately denounced that statement. And so the delegation was quite embarrassed, because it was them who wrote that statement as a compromise statement. So then they had a choice. What do they do? Do they go back to their churches and say, well, we are sorry, or do they stick to the statement that they did? And that was the position in which Bayers Moody found himself after the Cottesloe consultation. They tried to write a compromise statement, a minority statement explaining the Cottesloe resolution, but still the church wasn't satisfied with that. And the end result was that there was they ordered them not to have anything to do with that statement. And then when they refused, when Bayers had to make a decision about that.
Yeah. Also, one of the dividing line was that the NHGAP and the government, when it advocated for separation of races, it was basing that on the Bible. And Bayers, with a lot of the Sharpeville and the Cottesloe consultation, he began to try and get the people involved in studying what the Bible, where in the Bible are these texts justified. And then he started what we call the
Pro-Veritate newsletter.
Yeah, newsletter,
yeah.
Where theologians could come up and could write in an article and grappling with the issues of race based on the Bible. And that day included the government and one of its newsletters and newspapers, and these are taking bears on this justification of separate of the unity of people for whatever race. And that led him to establish what you call the Christian Institute, where different...
The Christian what?
Christian Institute.
Institute, okay.
Yeah. An institute which was a... was to be a... an institute which was to be... to train in... addresses and consultation with different people from different churches.
I think at that time Bayer's problem was that most Afrikaners did not know a lot about this South Africa, and he thought that because the churches themselves, as churches, it's difficult for them to work together. It's better that individual ministers join the institute where they meet with ministers of other, and then they were simply holding Bible studies together, discussing what's happening, and then they would invite the guest speaker to inform them about what's happening in the township. So it was an institute for Christian leaders, but it was mainly intended for Africans ministers to hold Bible studies, because then their churches, the church had separated itself. So it was better for, he thought that the institute would play that role of a drawing. But then when he was when the institute was appointing the director, he was appointed the first director. And the church, the Dutch Reformed Church, then said that any minister who joins the institute will be fired from the Dutch Reformed Church. And that automatically meant that Beyers himself, if he accepts that position of a director, must mean that he's no longer a dominion of the Dutch Reformed Church. And that is where the split between him and the Dutch Reformed Church happened. And
his friend also, who was not a Buddha born, was immediately fired from the church for being involved in the Christian Institute. But then at that time, when he did it, he wanted to fight back and say, it's all a vendetta against me because I'm not a Buddha born. It's part of the whole thing about Buddha born. If you're not a part of it, you can easily be eliminated, or your position, anybody could be put in your place who is a Buddha born. So, and then he asked Bayers about the documents of Buddha born, so that he wanted to defend himself in court, because then he was going to fight the church in court about his expulsion. So he went to Bayers and asked him, does he have any documents about the Buddha born? How does it help? How does it run? And all that. So Bayers naively gave him the documents, because at that time he was really now fighting within himself whether is he advocating or doing what God wants him to do, or is he doing what the Buddha wants. So he was fighting himself against balance, and also balancing himself against them. So he naively gave the minister his document, and 2 days later, the whole exposure was on major English newspapers, and I mean, it was just disaster for Afrikaners, because they never thought there would be somebody who knew what they stand for, the activities and all that.
So who are the members? How do they join?
Yeah.
The first.
Their aims and goals.
The exposure of this Buddha point.
And the minister went in. It was Marie Kumisho.
Ben Marie.
Yeah. So when, and then he handed back the before he wrote that he gave the exposure to the newspaper, gave the papers back to Bayers. And Bayers' defense was that, well, because all the other ministers and Afrikaners and Buddha Bond, all members of the society and government and church, they didn't know who could have done that. But then they had a suspicion that Bayers could be the person.
So during the expose, his name was never brought up initially.
It took some time before, probably a week or so before that. And they started searching out for people and all that, who could be the possible person. But they had in mind that it could be Bayers, but they never thought that there could be anybody who would
What year was that again?
I think it's around 68 or so. Oh, okay. Much later, 70.
Maybe early 70s.
Early 70s. 72. 72, I think, yeah. Yeah.
So about that time, Bayas was now beginning, and I think an important phase in the country was the emergence of the Black Consciousness Movement. And then he was now, he played an important role in giving assistance. But then he was not really central to the extent that one can say he is the father of, you know, since normally used in that language. But said he gave just an encouragement, because then around the 70s the Black Consciousness Movement emerged, when now the black communities themselves were organizing. Because before then it was most of these Anglican English speaking leaders who were doing everything, speaking on behalf of the blacks. The South African Institute of Race Relations, which was dealing with the problems of African people, was led by the English speaking whites. And the Dutch Reformed hated that, because in their past history, the English always did so many things against the Afrikaner, saying that they are doing that, protecting the blacks, but in reality, just for themselves. And one of the things that the Dutch Reformed theologians did not like was what they called the double morality or hypocrisy of the English-speaking churches. That they were ready to condemn the African churches, whereas they are doing the same thing in not allowing the blacks to this, the rights that they're supposed to, even in their churches. But then the phase then, when the Black Consciousness Movement emerged, and the government now started a heavy attack now on the blacks, and Bayas included was, and then the Christian Institute was also learning through mistakes, by trying not to dominate or to speak on behalf of blacks, but allow the Black Consciousness Movement to do that. So one of the things he did was to help, was to establish a project which was called the University Christian Movement, UCM. And University Christian Movement was the first one in South Africa to organize a black theology conference, which allowed black theologians for the first time to come together and say, what is our theology? And Bayas kept at the background. And so, the next thing led to the other. After that, we have a situation where the Christian Institute established a certain project which is called SPROCES. Now SPROCES, I think, is something like study project on apartheid society or apartheid. So it had divisions. One division on housing, labor, economics, and so on. And at that time, the Christian Institute now was moving from an institute of Bible studies for ministers to an institute which now begins to both work with black organizations and also to begin to have more detailed study and information about the nature of the problem of apartheid. And so it started to compile statistics and so on and so on. And as it was doing that, it was becoming more and more relevant to the black community side, and more dangerous from the state side. And so the conflict reaches 1977, where 76, then there is the Soweto riots. And by the Soweto riots, the Christian Institute plays that role side by side with this Council of Churches, South African Council of Churches. Then in 1977, after the death of Steve Biko, even before that, the government starts to investigate the Christian Institute, what they call the Slebusch Commission. And the Slebusch Commission, which is a judge, Slebusch, makes the Christian Institute an affected organization, in effect meaning that it must disclose who are its overseas donors or supporters. And the Christian Institute then started. In fact, the period between that phase of the Christian Institute drawing closer to the black community and 1977 was the most difficult period in Bayas' life, honestly, because they were really under heavy attack by the state. And the neighbors of Bayas Nodi, his cars, his wheels were slashed. all the things were done on him personally. Relatives, friends, or everything, they just kept it standard. But in 1977, when the government banned organization, they served the personal banning order on Beyers Nondi, and then they banned the Christian Institute. And then for the then he was just there isolated. There was no contact. He was not allowed contact, and other people also chose not to have contact with him, especially in the white community.
He under house arrest or what?
It's something close to
maybe certain hours.
Yeah, certain, but within certain hours. Mm-hmm. And within a certain ministerial district, he could move within over certain areas.
Yeah. And that was lifted in 1984. Couldn't travel. Didn't have a passport.
Mm-hmm. So from 77 to 84 was?
Yeah, it was a pending order.
When a person is banned, do they have police watching them the whole time?
You're banned. And there is a police watching you. They may watch you overtly at certain times, and sometimes there is somebody you don't know who's watching you. Once you break the banning order, thinking that they're not watching you, then they'll come and charge you. And there are many people who were banned who were charged. Beyers Nondi was never charged, which means they never, maybe he never broke it in a way that they saw. Mm-hmm.
And he couldn't be quoted in newspapers, he couldn't be in any publication, he couldn't write anything in any paper.
Mm-hmm. And people had to consult with him secretly and go. But during that time, churches in Germany played a very great big role in helping him, supporting him, and then they were there. And he worked. And slowly, the government itself, things started working against him, because what Beyers Nondi did during that time when he was under banning order, he sent many Dutch Reformed leaders to be trained in Europe. And you can only enter Europe on the word of Beyers Nondi, because the Dutch Reformed as a church was no longer recognized. It was expelled. Mm. Well, it moved out of the World Council of Churches during the Cortes consultation. Mm. And from there, before that time, all the Dutch Reformed ministers were trained. They did their liberal arts in South Africa, and masters, and went to the Germany or Amsterdam Free University for doctorate. But after the conflict with Beyers Nondi, the universities, they were pressurized not to accept the only whites who went there were those who Beyers Nondi said they can't go. In other words, anything that those governments had to do, they had to ask Beyers Nondi, should we help the government? Should we give the government a loan or not? And so on. And many then Beyers started sending many black students now. I've not read the background, but I would suspect that Allen Busack was one of those who started going out, like in 1976, to study, or before that, through Beyers Nondi, getting scholarships for black students.
Because one of his fears was that because of apartheid and its education system, it was propagating a much lesser education for all other races, but a superior one for whites. And that was in all spheres, in public schools, university level, theological seminars, especially which were run by the Ngaka camp. And so he felt that you have to strengthen people in their fields so that they know more. Don't give them half-baked potatoes and send them out in churches. But they need a clear theological training, which is by any standard equivalent to anybody, not just dictated for the higher theological training for whites and not for blacks.
And at about the same time,